going to go back would come out. Several gay political reporters started to refer to Robbie as a cute robot assembled in a closet in Vermont. Asked again why young voters weren't supporting Hillary, Robbie said, "You'd have to ask the voters that." Hired gun guy, sensing a malfunction, earned his keep. He staged a hostile takeover, picking up the toughest questions and answering with his usual smooth elan of a spokesman for BP after the oil spill. Reporter: "Do you or do you not think there's an element of sexism the way he, Bernie's talking about Hillary Clinton?" Mook: I'm gonna leave you guys to judge that." Hired gun guy: "Can I make one comment on that?" Then, hired gun guy, who looked less and less like Ben Affleck as the campaign wore on, with dark circles under his eyes and the pasty skin of someone who spent too much time in a drab office building in Brooklyn and a Manchester Radisson, went into a lengthy presentation about Bernie's troubling adoption of the same attacks lobbed by the so-called Bernie bros. "It can be vitriolic," he said, "and I think the Sanders campaign needs to be aware the extent to which, in an effort to mobilize and galvanize their supporters, they let the mentality or crudeness of the bros seep into their own words and criticisms that they hurl at Secretary Clinton." After Iowa, the bros, a vile caboodle of loosely organized online trolls who harassed anyone, particularly those of us with vaginas, who seemed disloyal to Bernie, became emboldened. Every time I wrote about Hillary, I heard from enraged bros furious that the media had discounted their man. They flooded the Times comments section and wrote letters to the editors littered with four-letter words. They regularly addressed me as a NY Times prostitute, a donkey-faced whore, and a life support system for a cunt who works for the New York Times. People started to whisper that Brooklyn had invented the bros in some dark arts effort to drive young women to their rightful place with her. I like a good Clinton conspiracy as much as the next reporter, but Brooklyn didn't create the bros. It took six staffers and a focus group to compose an official tweet signed with an H. "For approval, slight edit to tweet," the emails read. There was no way Hillary's campaign had the creativity to come up with NY Times prostitute. Now, hired gun guy was trying to tell us that Bernie and his bros were one and the same because Bernie had the anti-woman audacity to claim Hillary wasn't a true progressive. The offending line came at a CNN forum the day before the breakfast when Bernie said, "Some of my best friends are moderates, but you can't be a progressive and a moderate at the same time." As hired gun guy made his case, the press rolled our collective eyes so far back in our heads that the first question that popped in my mind was from the movie Heathers. "Did you have a brain tumor for breakfast?" Somebody let out a groan and said, "Come on, do you think the umbrage really fits the comment here? I mean, he was asked if he thought she was a progressive. He basically said, well, she said she was a moderate, and she says she's a progressive, and you can't be both." That's not exactly the insult of the century. I would just put it back and say, what's the intent in making the comment? In trying to deprive her of the compliment it is to be called a progressive? Hired gun guy said. Robot Robbie sat silently, his lips pursed into a heart shape. I hadn't realized Hillary was such a delicate flower, but I understood the frustration. She'd spent much of her career trying to overcome a caricature of the liberal feminist. She'd written her senior thesis on Saul Alinsky and told the Wellesley women of 69 that politics was the art of making what appears impossible, possible. As First Lady, she'd been the leftist foil to her husband's centrist agenda. She'd privately opposed NAFTA, pushed for universal health care, lamented the welfare overhaul that gutted federal assistance of the poor by $55 billion, and effectively ended her friendship with her mentor, Marion Wright Edelman. The West Wing called Hillary Land the Bolsheviks. But even in a primary race when she could have used her progressive past to help brush back Bernie's attacks from the left, Hillary never mentioned the Bolsheviks or any of this, too afraid of sounding like she opposed her husband's administration and of rekindling the old commie caricature that she'd worked so hard to shake and that would haunt her in a general election. We are all forged in the crucible of our mistakes. I had to practically pound on the table to get Robbie and hired gun guy to take a question from the estrogen-heavy end of the room. I asked if Hillary had expressed to her top aides her frustration that she spent most of her career trying not to be a liberal cartoon, and now she was trying to convince voters that she was a progressive who likes to get things done. The way I remembered it, I phrased this question brilliantly, inserting cultural nuances and gender dynamics into an otherwise dry political debate. But when I looked back at the transcript, this is what I actually said. Has she ever, like, expressed to her aides frustration that, like, Jesus, the whole early part of my career was inaudible, that I wasn't, like, a scary, bra-burning liberal inaudible? We need to convince them that I have been there on all these issues? Snorts from the middle of the table. Yeah, when is she gonna burn her bra, Heilman said. The breakfast had descended into an episode of Beavis and Butthead. Are there burnt bras in the archives in Little Rock? If so, when will we see them? All Robbie could say was, wow. After the bra breakfast, I wanted to run away from the Radisson, get in my Subaru, and drive to the bar class in Bedford that I'd found the day before. A former state representative taught the class in a carpeted attic converted into a workout studio. Christmas lights hung overhead, and clients affixed paper hearts for Valentine's Day to the walls with messages like, I love me and I heart God. Instead, I ended up in a lobby showdown with Policy Guy over a web-only story that had long been lost in the news cycle and the deluge of post-Iowa, pre-New Hampshire hot takes. I needed to defuse the situation, to stop being so defensive and just give him the apology he wanted to hear. But when I did, the words came out as sincere as Hillary's, I'm sorry that this has been confusing to people. Look, I hear you, I said. I'm sorry you hated that story, but my meter ran out and I've really got to go. No, tell me, he said, swerving his neck forward and down to meet my eyes as I pretended to dig around for my keys. Are you in my head? Apparently so. I would have had more patience for this ass-ripping had the Clintons not simultaneously sponged off my reporting. I spent months reporting a feature about how Hillary had gone undercover to investigate school segregation in the South. Dothan, Alabama. On a humid summer day in 1972, Hillary Rodham walked into this town's new private academy, a couple of cinder block classrooms erected hurriedly amid fields of farmland, and pretended to be someone else. The guys, as usual, doubted my motives and tried to kill the story. It ran right around Christmas on the front page, the primest of prime real estate the Clintons, a couple of times print subscribers in their late 60s, could have hoped for. By February, at the same time Brooklyn was ready to string me up in a plaza in Manchester, the Clintons had turned my reporting into full-blown agitprop. Hillary was 24 when Marion Wright Edelman's advocacy group was investigating the hundreds of private schools that sprung up across the South to cater to white families after the 1969 Supreme Court decision forced public schools to integrate. She went to Dothan, a town near the Chattahoochee River, and the Fort Rucker Army Base, named after Genesis 37:17. They have gone away, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. She pretended to be a housewife who wanted to enroll her son in the town's new private academy. I went through my role-playing, asking questions about the curriculum and makeup of the student body, Hillary wrote in Living History. I was assured that no black students would be enrolled. For whatever reason, Hillary didn't like to talk about Dothan. She devoted only 300 words in her 567-page memoir to the experience. Even during the 2008 primary, amid accusations of racism, Hillary didn't talk about her undercover work. You think that would have been good to know? A guy from the 08 campaign said after my story ran. When I initially told the guys I wanted to do a deeper piece about this brief chapter of Hillary's career, they assumed I'd make her look shady or underhanded. You always find a way, they'd said. She'd recently told voters at a diner in Manchester that the Marine Corps turned her away in 1975, biographical color that led to at least 3 days of mockery and two Pinocchios from the Washington Post's fact-checkers. I cried, actually broke down in my mother's bathtub in San Antonio over Thanksgiving weekend after a Brooklyn source told me Hillary hadn't even considered my months of interview requests. But this is a positive story. I'm not trying to screw anyone, I said between sobs. And she just gave an interview to the Boston Globe. Why not the Times? Oh, yeah, he said. Well, Annie Linsky went to Wellesley, so she wanted to do it. Now, with Hillary about to lose New Hampshire and reliant on a firewall of black voters in the South, my undercover Hillary story became political gold. Tangible evidence on the front of the Times that she'd been at the forefront of civil rights. She was a progressive who liked to get things done. Without mentioning me or the Times, Bill started to refer crowds to a very nice article in the press. He painted a portrait of Hillary as a young activist, unafraid and on a mission in the Deep South when women didn't do such things. He added a few factual flourishes. She posed as a housewife who'd just moved to this little town in Alabama, and you know, she made small talk with the guy at the school, I heard Bill say at an event in Rochester, New Hampshire. It took guts 40 years ago to do that, and it changed, and they lost their tax exemptions and had to change all their practices. Houston Academy, the private school Hillary visited and that I toured in the course of my reporting, didn't lose its tax-exempt status. In 2013, 8 of its 527 students were black. Bill loved the undercover Hillary story so much that months later he made it a central part of his primetime address to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. They exchanged pleasantries, and finally she said, "Look, let's just get to the bottom line here. If I enroll my son in this school, will he be in a segregated school, yes or no?" And the guy said, "Absolutely," he told a hushed Wells Fargo center. She had him. I may have been in open warfare with the Hillary who won Iowa with the help of a coin toss and who thought I was an insipid bottom feeder. But I adored the Hillary who went undercover that summer in Alabama. The Hillary who met with civil rights leaders in Atlanta and rented a car and drove to Dothan, where she checked herself in at a Holiday Inn off Ross Clark Circle. I pulled up my fur-lined hood and made my escape back into the grimy Manchester air. I heard the salt and ice on the sidewalks crush beneath my boots. I wanted to believe that this Hillary would have kind of liked me too. Chapter 27, Saint Hillary. Flint, Michigan, February 2016. Saint or sinner, moralist or Machiavelli, Mother Teresa or Lady Macbeth, Diane Blair wrote in a 1996 journal entry. Hillary, like most of us, some of both and much in between. The black block letters on the low-hung billboard hovering over the awning of a Metro PCS store, the only vibrant retail I saw in Flint, other than a pawn shop and a funeral home, if a funeral home can count as retail, read, "Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation. Romans 12:12." It was Sunday morning, 48 hours before the polls opened in New Hampshire and 730 miles away. Most of the travelers stayed behind in Manchester, but I'd made my way to Flint so I could go to church with Hillary. The water crisis had become a national health emergency, and Hillary was still one of the only politicians and the only candidate really talking about it. I waited at the end of the second-to-last row of purple-upholstered pews at the House of Prayer Missionary Baptist Church. The lead came from the Flint River, and the corroded pipes had pumped the brown sludge into public schools and kitchens and bathrooms in homes that had once been aspirational middle-class bungalows, but that now dotted the landscape of post-industrial blight. On the drive to Flint, I'd passed a truck propped up on cinder blocks and spray-painted with the silvery sprawl of "Make America Great Again." If there were a travel poster advertising like a cruise getaway to this previously great America, it would have looked like Flint, when it was white and before the factories closed. In the church bathroom, as Reverend Kenneth L. Stewart delivered a sermon about Flint being on God's waiting list, I saw a little girl in braids and a white dress perch on her patent leather tippy toes to wash her hands. I ran into the stall and sobbed. The Flint trip slapped me upside the head and woke me up from my fights with the guys, my wrestling over bylines, all my unimportant coastal concerns. I went to Flint mostly because I wanted to see Hillary in a different setting after so many town halls in Iowa and New Hampshire where almost everyone was white. The Flint trip signified the next stage of the race when she would rely on black voters. Critics would describe the visit as the most jarring example of Brooklyn's over-reliance on identity politics, and Hillary's over-reliance on the black voters who elected Obama twice. But when I got to Flint, it didn't feel like pandering or identity politics. It didn't feel like politics at all. A young woman told me she'd miscarried twins. A mother of four said her 8-year-old son had been bright, smarter than most in his first grade class, until the lead got into his blood. A man pulled up the sleeve of his maroon suit jacket to show me the chalky white rash that ran from his wrists up his arms and wouldn't wash away. I asked Bobby Blake, a pastor at another local church, if people thought Hillary was there because she needed black voters. "I don't care why she came," Blake told me. "This town has been living out of a bottle. My question is, where's everybody else?" For over a year, I would go to at least one black church with Hillary almost every Sunday. We went to black churches in North Carolina, Mississippi, Tennessee, Kansas City, Texas, and Brooklyn. I started to learn the rhythms, how Hillary would always step to the pulpit, take a deep, freeing Sunday morning inhale, and then open her remarks with Psalm 118:24. "This is the day the Lord hath made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it." She'd talk about working to end systemic racism, and well before the general election, she shat all over Trump's slogan. "America has never stopped being great," she told the Greater Imani Cathedral of Faith in Memphis. When the choir belted out "Glory, glory, hallelujah," I couldn't help but shake my shoulders. I pretended to look down at my phone as I bowed my head and mouthed the words, "Lift every voice and sing." Between the hours of 10 a.m. and noon, Hillary became a different person. She recited scripture with the fluency of a renowned theologian, the verve of a TV evangelist. She loved the Epistle of James. Scripture tells us that faith without works is dead. She said she tried to live up to the prophet Micah's teachings that we do justice, love, kindness, and walk humbly with God. She explained that her Christianity is a journey that never ends. She described her calling as answering the charge given to us by Jesus, as Matthew records, and heaping love on the least, the last, and the lost. In another life, she could have been a Methodist pastor or Princeton theology professor. She could have been a spiritual guide, steering her young congregants not to slumber while the world changed around us, as she often said she learned in 1962 when her own youth minister, Don Jones, at the First United Methodist Church in Park Ridge, took her to hear Martin Luther King Jr. speak. On the campaign plane in 2008, I saw Hillary, late into the night, reading the leather-bound Bible that she travels with. But only once a week would she step to the pulpit and publicly draw into this divine reserve. "This is the day the Lord hath made." Hillary used to talk about her faith all the time. In a 1993 speech at my alma mater in Austin, Hillary said the country was suffering from a crisis of meaning. "We need a new politics of meaning. We need a new ethos of individual responsibility and caring. We need a new definition of civil society as to how we can have a society that fills us up again and makes us feel that we are part of something bigger than ourselves," she said. The Austin speech led to a New York Times Magazine cover story by Michael Kelly, who by then was on his way to becoming a neocon. "Saint Hillary, more preacher than politician, the First Lady seeks a new reformation, concerned less with how government should behave than with how people should," the headline read. The Times story made Hillary seem like a kooky, new-agey do-gooder. She quoted Dietrich Bonhoeffer and said that "the very core of what I believe is this concept of individual worth, which I think flows from all of us being creatures of God and being imbued with the Spirit." If there's one thing the political press can't stand, it's sanctimony. The mockery came from all sides. The Atlantic said the First Lady had pulled on a quasi-mystical socio-politico-psychological coat of crazy colors. After that, Hillary rarely talked about her spiritual side. She even hesitated to wear all white, as she had for the Times cover photo, until 23 years later when she won the Democratic Party's nomination. Still endless press about St. Hillary piece by Michael Kelly, Diane Blair wrote at the time. Another thing to blame the Times for. The GOP candidates, by contrast, were tripping all over themselves to prove their Christian bona fides. A few days after Trump referred to the Second Corinthians as Two Corinthians, making the eighth book of the New Testament sound like a buddy sitcom set in Athens, Maggie Haberman and I sat a few rows behind and to the left of Trump at the First Presbyterian Church in Muscatine, Iowa. Trump, his communications director Hope Hicks, and campaign manager Corey Lewandowski arrived late to the little red brick chapel up the street from a frozen river scattered with ice fishermen. Trump stayed for the whole sermon about the world's largest ball of twine in Darwin, Minnesota, a metaphor for unexpected gifts. "We don't have much of a town left, but that twine ball really draws them in." He then dropped two crispy $50 bills into the collection plate. When all the politics and caution were stripped away, Hillary was, at her core, a Methodist, a church lady, a fire and brimstone Jesus saves believer. When I try to tell people this, they always say she's just another pandering politician. Trust me, you don't drop the prophet Micah in mid-conversation because you're pandering. You can't fake extended allusions to the eight Beatitudes of Jesus as she did during a town hall in Knoxville, Iowa, or casually quote the Jesuit academic Henry Nouwen's parable on the prodigal son during a CNN town hall, as Hillary did in response to a rabbi's question in Manchester. Regardless of how hard the days are, how difficult the decisions are, be grateful. Be grateful for being a human being, being part of the universe, Hillary told the rabbi. Be grateful for your limitations. By the time Hillary arrived in Flint, her limitations were all anyone was talking about, myself included. In the finale of the sermon, Stuart declared to the congregation, now on their feet and filled with the temporary ecstasy of imminent salvation, "Hillary Clinton is on the waiting list," and "Have I got a witness?" And the crowd shouted, "Amen!" Hillary took her place behind a wooden podium that dwarfed her small frame so that only her head and an inch or two of her tweed jacket showed. Behind her was a choir in purple and gold sleeves and a mural of a black, bare-chested Jesus being baptized in the River Jordan. Ushers in white uniforms settled into whatever empty seats they could find. By then, some local reporters and the network embeds, who had also made the trip from Manchester, filled out the back pews. "I am here because for nearly 2 years, Flint's water was poisoned," Hillary said, sounding as I imagined the young activist who went undercover in Alabama in 1972 had sounded. "I'm here because for nearly 2 years, mothers and fathers were voicing concerns about the water's color, about the smell, about the rashes it gave to those who were bathing in it. Clean water is not optional, my friends. It's not a luxury," she said. "This is not merely unacceptable or wrong, though it is both. What happened in Flint is immoral." Immoral. It wasn't a word presidential candidates, especially Democrats, usually used. But I wasn't watching a politician. This was Saint Hillary. The Sunday school teacher awakened by the left-leaning youth minister who believed in the Methodist tenet that the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world that it leaves to its children. The first lady who defended her husband's infidelity in biblical terms. "You know, in Christian theology there are sins of weakness and sins of malice, and this was a sin of weakness." By the time I left the House of Prayer to get a flight back to Boston and cab it back to Manchester, Flint wasn't the story, not even close. Bill Clinton had gone off message. He told a crowd in Milford, New Hampshire that Bernie was a hermetically sealed hypocrite. "When you're making a revolution, you can't be too careful with the facts," he said. Meanwhile, Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem had declared war on young women for supporting Bernie, making Hillary seem like the embodiment of antiquated mean girl feminism and driving even further away the voters she'd hoped to inspire. "There's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other," Albright, then 78, had said at a rally, repeating a line she often used. And Steinem, at a very sexy 81, had pronounced on Bill Maher, "When you're young, you're thinking, where are the boys? The boys are with Bernie." Cue outrage. My flight was delayed. The embeds and I settled into a booth at a TGI Fridays at the Detroit airport. By the time I finally got back to Manchester, it was after 3 a.m. I fell into my bed with all my clothes on, and the dry heat of a mid-range hotel cranked up on high, wondering if Flint and St. Hilary had even really happened. Chapter 28. I Hate Everyone. Manchester to New York City, New York City to Las Vegas, February 2016. The morning of the New Hampshire primary, I was bound for another web-only story about why Hillary lost. I was killing myself on the road and still falling behind. My editors weren't thinking about me to write the main stories. My colleagues bulldozed me on primary and debate nights. "Oh, it's just easier for so-and-so to write it because he's here," was usually how editors would explain it to me when I whined. And Jesus, did I whine. I whined so much that even on a team of master whiners, an exasperated editor told me as he loaded a Flavia pack into the hotel coffee maker that I was the worst. "Please, you mean I'm worse than so-and-so who everyone could hear screaming at you through closed doors?" "Yes." "Worse than so-and-so who refused to leave New York for more than 2 days and then complained the whole time he was here?" "Yes." "Worse than so-and-so who is usually on cable TV when everyone else is slaving away on deadline?" "Yes." I adopted Hillary's mood. I went around despondent and aggrieved, pissed off at the world, at my editors, at myself for not being likable enough. I'd even caught the sinus infection Hillary had been fighting off. When friends would check in on me, I'd send them all a meme of Toby Ziegler, the fictional White House communications director on the West Wing, looking suicidal in a drab brown suit with the quote, "There is literally no one in the whole world I don't hate right now." Jen Palmieri told me Hillary had been working through a lot in her head when she got introspective at a town hall at New England College right before the primary. "I am who I am," Hillary said. "I can't do some kind of personality transformation." Same. After nearly 12 weeks straight on the road, one caucus, one primary, and countless days eating multiple meals at the Panera Bread, I'd hoped to spend some time in New York. I missed Bobby and the Lower East Side and Kale. I'd been wearing the same three Old Navy turtlenecks in black, blue, and gray for months. But Carolyn had other plans. In her Carolyn way, she explained as we sat on lawn chairs in the stuffy pool room at the Marriott Courtyard the morning of the New Hampshire primary, that she needed me to be the Nevada bureau chief. There was no such thing as the Nevada bureau chief. She needed me to keep an eye on the Democrats while most of the team focused on the GOP primary in South Carolina. I didn't care. I was just relieved to feel the warmth of Carolyn's sunshine on me again. I said yes and then started to explain that I needed to go home for a couple days. "I've got to do laundry, repack. I haven't seen Bobby in weeks," I started. I hadn't intended it, but there's a better-than-average chance that this sounded like whining. Before I could finish the sentence, Carolyn turned her head toward the windows and squinted. At least a foot of fresh snow had fallen on top of the grimy older snow, bringing with it the chill of Carolyn's disappointment. The air smelled of chlorine, and steam rose from a hexagon-shaped hot tub. "Well," she said, "I guess I could get Adam to do it." She meant Adam Nagorny, the Times' senior-most political correspondent and a national treasure who'd been covering presidential campaigns since I was getting flicked in the head in the hallways at Hobby Middle School. Carolyn is a master motivator. She knew all our pressure points and pressed them in exactly the right way to get us to perform at our highest levels, even when we felt so out of fuel that we'd prefer to collapse on the field, as I did that day in Manchester. My pressure point was the fear that one of my more esteemed colleagues would overshadow me on the Hillary beat and prove the guys right. I fell for this every time. Explained to Carolyn that I had non-refundable theater tickets and needed to leave the office by 7:30 p.m. "Well, I can see if Pat wants to write it." Start to spit out that Bobby planned a special anniversary dinner for us. "Okay, no problem. I mean, if you're busy, I can check with Michael." And every time, I replied, just as I did by the indoor pool, "No, I'll do it." "Fabulous, you're a star," Carolyn said, popping up from the lawn chair, its silver plastic strips sagging from where she sat. Harry Reid asked if I was enjoying his state. "We've got no humidity here, so your hair won't frizz," he said. I realize this may seem like an odd thing for the senior-ranking Democratic senator to say, but my only thought was, how did he know? For months in Iowa and New Hampshire, my brittle split ends made my hair the consistency of a West Texas tumbleweed, with the added static of my synthetic wool Times hat that I hardly ever took off except to sleep and shower. But thanks to a couple days in the dry desert air of Las Vegas and the lemongrass citrus deep conditioner provided by the Wynn Hotel and Casino, my curls felt springy and light. As a matter of fact, Senator, my hair hasn't looked this good in months, I told him. Maybe every Jewish girl should live in Nevada. Reed was right. A day into my Nevada bureau chief assignment, and I felt like the warden had urged me to orchestrate a prison break. 3 days earlier, Bernie had trampled Hillary in New Hampshire. It was a clear, crushing, brow-beating annihilation. Brooklyn knew Bernie would win by double digits, but they were thinking 11 or 12 points, not 22 fucking points. Hillary thanked supporters at Southern New Hampshire University in Hooksett in the same gym where 8 years earlier she'd unexpectedly beaten Obama and declared she'd found my own voice. I wrote that she left New Hampshire that night still searching for it. Do we have any sense from her what she believes or wants her core message to be? Joel Benenson had asked the team. Before I could set up the Times Nevada Bureau, also known as Room 1009 at the Wynn, I had to make a quick trip to Milwaukee for the next Democratic debate. I was in a Delta comfort seat when Brown Loafers came down the aisle and checked his boarding pass. He looked at me in the seat next to his, made one of his signature facial expressions, a feigned overbite, chin-forward grin, and exhaled as he sat, cursed by New Hampshire primary voters and the commercial airline gods. We made cordial small talk. I told him about the Iron Horse Hotel, my favorite boutique hotel in Milwaukee. It's nicer than the Bowery and costs like $120 a night. And about the local coffee. You've got to try Colectivo. I said Hillary needed to win the primary so my colleague Mark Landler's upcoming book about her foreign policy would sell. I've got a fair amount writing on this too, Brown Loafers replied. Then he flipped through the Times. He pretended to read for the rest of the flight, thumbing well into the vitamin pages, what we call stories that get banished to the inside pages, B6, B12, and so on. I pretended to nap. Because it would have been more awkward not to, we shared an Uber to the University of Wisconsin, and as we rushed inside the auditorium with minutes to spare before the debate started, a protester shouted, "Hillary Clinton is a criminal! And you're an asshole!" Brown Loafers yelled back. The protester, sweeping his homemade sign down to his side, started to lunge toward us, yelling, "Hillary for prison!" We sprinted up the stairs, past security, through steamy glass doors, locked to outsiders but open to us because we had our Secret Service credentials. Through the glass we heard yells of, "Go fuck yourselves!" We both laughed. Real laughter for once, not the scoffing, cruel kind that we'd directed at each other so many times. We shared something, an instant, that I forgot about entirely until many months later when the assholes of Wisconsin delivered the election to Trump. After the debate, Hillary added a speech in Harlem, a reset in the city that loved her the most. This gave me one night in New York, enough time to swap out my warmest winter clothes with some tank tops, sundresses, and a pair of sandals. Bobby and I tried to have breakfast at our favorite neighborhood diner, but I had to rush home to write a news story on Justice Antonin Scalia's death, leaving Bobby with a plate full of uneaten bacon and the bill. Later that day, I took a one-way JetBlue flight to Las Vegas. As Hillary morphed into a better version of herself in Clark County, so did I, letting go of all the crap that had built up in Iowa and New Hampshire. After so much time in states that felt alien, Las Vegas, especially away from the Strip, felt like San Antonio. There were rows of almost identical stucco homes like the ones my parents downsized to a couple years earlier, behind walled subdivisions with names like Alto Mesa and Hacienda Park. There were strip malls with tanning salons, even though the temperatures in the winter rarely dip below a sunny 65 degrees. The Mexican restaurants sold tacos al pastor and didn't charge for chips and salsa or try to top it all off with melted cheddar. And Spanish was everywhere, not like in Des Moines or Manchester where the language was treated like background noise from a kitchen. In Vegas, Annie Carney and I took boxing lessons from Brady, a former Ultimate Fighter with a shaved head and sinewy frame. Brady obviously hadn't met many journalists because he was shocked at our willingness to punch each other. I'd had so much pent-up rage and office drama playing out in my head that when Brady yelled, "Left hook," I'd thrown an uppercut that knocked his plastic name tag off. That night, Annie and I went to a Britney Spears concert. When a couple of male dancers in black leather first carried Britney onto the stage in an emerald sequin and nude getup that hardly covered her gyrating ass, a man behind me said, "Good for Brits, she got her body back." I wondered if I'd ever get my pre-campaign body back. A few songs in, while Brits flipped her blonde extensions as she lip-synced, "Work, bitch," I took a swig of my $17 margarita and realized that for the first time in months, I wasn't thinking about Hillary Clinton. By the time we got in a black car back to the Wynn, we were back to our usual stressing about newsroom dynamics and the campaign and our insecurities about what we and our colleagues would do with our lives when it all ended. "What's going to happen to Maggie if Trump wins?" Annie asked. The driver interrupted to say in a thick Bronx accent, "Yo, I don't know who this Maggie is, but what's going to happen to the country if Trump wins?" Hours later, I saw that Britney, all covered up in a tight white turtleneck and jeans, went to meet Hillary at her suite at Caesars, posting a photo, their heads of iconic bottle blonde hair touching, on Instagram, and calling her an inspiration and a beautiful voice for women around the world. When the campaign interpreted the post as an endorsement, Britney, or more likely her legal guardians, deleted the "I'm with her" hashtag, causing a mini-scandal and putting an inevitable Hillary taint on my memory of the Britney show. At this stage of the race, during the 08 primary, I'd been the pool reporter assigned to WJC duty. I'd never seen anything close to the tickled anarchy that ensued when Bill Clinton walked into a casino unannounced. 3, 2, 1, chaos, as the cocktail waitresses nearly dropped their trays and the senior citizens who sat on padded swivel chairs, shoving quarters into the slot machines, broke away from the glowing red sevens, and the tourists in town for a bachelor party seemed to yell, "Bro, it's Bill Clinton," in unison. "I'm from Arkansas. I met you in 1987 in Pine Bluff," a cook at Caesar's Palace told the former president. "Yeah, Don, I remember that. How's your mama doing?" I didn't see Clinton catch a passing glimpse at her name tag, but he must have. We'd been in the basement of the MGM Grand with showgirls and kitchen workers lined up for their chance to shake his hand. Bill Clinton had turned and looked me in the eyes and said something that, 8 years later, I kept going back to. "We had a little role reversal in New Hampshire. Hillary started running more of an insurgent campaign, an underdog campaign, and we like it that way. That's how it ought to be. We've been running as the underdog most of our lives." Hillary arrived back in Nevada, the underdog. A couple of months earlier, Bernie had been a non-entity in the state, but now his ads blanketed the airwaves in English and Spanish. He had organizers from Elko to Carson City, and polls showed he could edge out a victory. For the first time of the entire campaign, it dawned on the entire cocksure Clinton operation that she could actually blow this thing again. If there was any upside to the blowout in New Hampshire and the tightening polls in Nevada, it was that losing brought out Hillary's best self. I saw it over and over. Bill was right. She needed to run scared, as she had in 2008 after Iowa. It was the only way for her to tap into a deep reserve of retail campaigning talent. Hillary couldn't truly pour herself into a room unless she felt as though it was all slipping away. It was 12:35 a.m. local time on the Thursday before the Nevada caucuses when Hillary, in black slacks, glasses on, hair flattened from a day of travel, took the elevator downstairs at Caesar's Palace. She headed toward the bustling heart of the hotel, where mostly Latina housekeepers folded sheets and towels with tight corners and stacked them in bottom-heavy piles topped off with pillowcases and face towels. "My goodness," Hillary said, turning her head right and left to examine the scenes of curvy women in blue and black cotton uniforms loading their pillars of terry cloth and 700-thread-count cotton into wheeled plastic containers the color of an orange traffic cone. They lifted cupped hands to open mouths, blown away by the luminary in their midst. This wasn't Wayne Newton or the delicate acrobats and leotards and Eastern European accents who wrapped their legs over their heads and contorted themselves into human bicycle wheels each night in the Cirque du Soleil, all of whom essentially belonged to the same casino ecosystem as the lower castes. This was Hillary Clinton, and despite the drumbeat from Democrats that her campaign was joyless and a sentiment that even some supporters had summed up as, "I'm with her, I guess," Hillary's impromptu visit, hair messy, makeup untouched, moved these women on hourly wages and tired feet to tears. "Ay, Dios mío, mira la Hillary!" She reached both arms out in a wide embrace, one woman under each arm as if they were aunts lined up for a quinceañera portrait around a 15-year-old in a tiara. They screeched and dug into deep pockets, pulling out Android phones to snap photos. "I flew in from Chicago, so before I went to my room, I said, 'Well, who is still working?' The answer? A lot of people," Hillary said as she made her way through the windowless room with its lemony antiseptic scent of industrial-strength detergent. "Good to meet you. Thank you all. How's it going?" She asked about the women's hours, the 5 p.m. to 1 a.m. shift, they replied, as they kept folding towels, afraid to get behind. Hillary asked what they did. "So it's just towels and linens every day?" They chuckled politely at this question. "Yes, towels and linens every day." For a second, I wondered if Hillary, who had lived her life tethered to the daily uncertainty of the inevitable next crisis, felt some longing for this tedious, predictable work. Towels and linens every day. Hillary did this night after night before the Nevada caucuses. She met workers at the Paris-Las Vegas Hotel and Casino. "How does it work?" she said to a woman who loaded dirtied sheets into an industrial washing machine, and snuck up on a couple of tattooed cooks on break at Harrah's. At La Flor de Michoacan ice cream shop in North Las Vegas, she eyed the Mexican flavors, tamarind and guava and chocolate. "Lime!" brown loafers yelled when travelers asked what flavor ice cream she'd ordered. Hillary laughed. And at a children's soccer game in Henderson, she pretended to be a goalie, shifting left and right on the synthetic grass and yelling, "Oh no, oh no, oh no," as a runt of a 6-year-old in a glowing yellow jersey kicked the ball through the nets. Goal! She embraced all of Nevada's eccentricities, including the endorsement of 500 sex workers, mostly from Carson City brothels, who formed the Hookers for Hillary group. Even when there were only a couple of hours to go before the caucuses, Hillary tacked on a stop to Harrah's Casino. "I need your help this morning in the showroom at 11 a.m., she told the Spanish-speaking hotel staff. Hillary's style was so ripped from her husband's handbook, we might as well have been watching Bill Clinton work the crowd at the Bradley County Pink Tomato Festival in Arkansas. Despite what everyone, including Hillary, said about Hillary's political shortcomings, she dazzled at it. When she wanted to. The weekend before the caucuses, when a 10-year-old girl teared up and said she was scared that her parents would be deported, Hillary pulled her under an arm and held her close. "I'm going to do everything I can so you don't have to be scared, and you don't have to worry about what happens to your mom, your dad, or someone else in your family," she said. "Let me do the worrying. I'll do all the worrying. Is that a deal?" The campaign turned the moment into a shaky cam ad that ran throughout the primaries. It was this scrappy, downtrodden Hillary that Democrats had in mind after she left the State Department and every other capable Democrat, including the sitting vice president, had decided they didn't stand a chance against. She was a very good candidate in 2008 after she got knocked back. David Axelrod, who was no fan of the Clintons, had to concede. Instead of a battleship, she became a speedboat, and she got down on the ground and really, I thought, really connected to the middle-class voters and people who were struggling. People who were struggling connected with her when she looked like she was struggling. But that Hillary had hardly shown herself on the campaign so far. That fall, the pollster Peter Hart concluded that Hillary appeared to be behind a glass curtain. "Many voters," he said, "feel they can see her and hear her, but they do not think they can relate to or touch her. In their words, she is distant and remote." I asked Brooklyn why Hillary wasn't running like she did in 2008 when she was losing to Obama. Jen answered pointedly, "Because she's not losing." Chapter 29, You Should Be So Pretty. Las Vegas, February 2016. Working on Pacific time meant New York only needed me at 5 a.m. Pacific time when editors were heading into the office and usually wanted to know what the mood was on the ground. Are they nervous? What are the Clinton people saying? Do their internals show Bernie ahead? To which I replied, with varying degrees of politeness, "It's 5 a.m. here. Let me check on that when people wake up and get right back to you." And went back to sleep until the sun came up over the Las Vegas Valley, turning my 10th floor hotel room at the Wynn into an explosion of peachy nude tones. The tufted sofa and its ottoman, the floor-to-ceiling curtains that swung open at the flick of a bedside switch, the lampshades that glowed pink on top of marble bases, the circular table with the in-hotel magazines fanned out on top, the checkered carpet and the leather office chair on its silver swivel base, all bathed in peach. This color scheme could only exist in a high-end hotel in a city where winter boots meant thigh-high Christian Louboutins. I squinted at the reflection that bounced off the gold edifice with the word Trump stamped in Chinese aluminum from the Trump Hotel just outside my window. The T on the tower's white rim practically cast a Batman shadow on my California King bed. In the other direction stood the Treasure Island where I'd stayed with my Grandma Rose on a trip to Vegas for my 21st birthday. Everything I saw in Vegas reminded me of my dad's mom, an artist and card shark who slept in silk negligees, traveled with a miniature wet bar, and had the misfortune of being born a world-weary woman in 1920 in a dry, heavily Baptist county in Waco, Texas. This affliction of being trapped in an era before her time gave Grandma an underdeveloped maternal instinct and almost non-existent brain-to-mouth filter. When I was 11, I propped my head up on bent elbows lying on the shag carpet in the living room of her pink ranch house. Wheel of Fortune was on, and I committed the unspeakable faux pas of saying I didn't think Vanna White was that pretty. Grandma nearly choked on her gin martini. "You should be so pretty," she said from the sofa, and then patted her lap as she yelled, "A change of heart," completing the puzzle when the lineup of TV contestants were still mulling whether to buy another vow. Widowed twice, Grandma had, in her twilight years, a stash of untouched savings that provided her with a comfortable middle-class life that included a Lexus and regular Southwest flights to Vegas. On my 21st birthday trip, I hardly saw her despite our sharing a room at the Treasure Island. "You're asleep already," Grandma said when she turned on the lights in our room and rummaged around for her checkbook so she could get back down to the tables. On the last day of the trip, she woke me up early and offered to buy me a Bloody Mary at the tables. "Grandma, they're free," I said, pulling a pillow over my head. Grandma had been dead and buried for 10 months when I felt her resurrected in Vegas. I could hardly walk by a blackjack table without thinking about Rose in the sequined boleros with matching earrings and handbags that she'd painted on with hot glue and glitter bought in bulk at the Hobby Lobby and that she wore daily in Waco, but that only really made sense in Vegas. I remembered the Treasure Island being swanky when we'd stayed there. But when Bobby, who came to visit me for a weekend during the pre-Nevada caucus stretch, and I went back to play the $5 blackjack tables, the lobby felt worn in, neglected. The casino reeked of cigarette smoke. The retail offerings included a Krispy Kreme, a Jilly's trading post with embellished Western-themed denim jackets, and an accessories store that sold rhinestone-studded purses and gold lame pashminas, all for under $10. It was all so Grandma. We lost $100 in less than 45 minutes and left cranky and swearing off the Treasure Island altogether. By day 3, I'd turned the word Grandma into an adjective I used so frequently it's shocking it didn't find its way into my Times copy. The Sinatra-themed Italian steakhouse Bobby and I ate at, with its red tablecloths and matching red lacquered chairs and menu items like Osobuco My Way, wasn't bad, but it was definitely Grandma. On day 9, I came close to splurging on a pair of royal blue satin flats with a mirrored diamond-lined spinner affixed to the toe like a roulette wheel, displayed behind glass in an indoor walkway on the way to the Wynn's free parking garage. But were they too Grandma? I sent a picture to Michael Barbaro in the New York newsroom asking for his opinion. He wrote back immediately, "Come home, right now. Your judgment has been compromised." There is a photo of Hillary, sandwiched between Grandma and me after a rally in Waco before the Texas primary in 2008. A week earlier, a Dallas policeman, Victor Lozado Tirado, a 49-year-old father of four, was accompanying the Hillary motorcade when his motorcycle hit a curb and spun out of control. I was looking out the window when it happened. In an instant, the skid of a tire on the cement, his bike flipping behind him. The motorcade kept moving. By the time we got to the Dallas rally, we heard he'd been killed. Hillary said she was greatly heartsick over the loss of life in the line of duty. The alt-right website InfoWars added the officer to the list of the Clinton body count. A CNN reporter asked if Hillary would still be taking questions from the press. "Somebody just died," Jamie, the 08 campaign press wrangler, yelled, the only time I'd ever heard her lose her temper. Seeing someone die out the window of the bus doesn't go away. I was washing my hands in the bathroom and drying them with a soggy roll of stiff brown paper towels at the Waco event when I decided to do something for Grandma that I'd never done for anyone else in my family. I asked her if she wanted to meet Hillary after the rally. Grandma was reapplying her Miami Vice red lipstick in the mirror when she replied, "And why would I want to do that?" I don't remember ever talking politics with Grandma. She wasn't one of my relatives who watched Fox News all day and had the car radio set to Rush Limbaugh. I don't remember her ever saying who she voted for or if she voted at all. I replied with the one reason I thought would sway Grandma. Because she's the former First Lady and is famous and everyone wants to meet her? "Oh, all right," Grandma said, tossing her lipstick back into her handbag. The second Hillary saw Grandma in her charcoal suit with black piping along the collar and an onyx pendant that matched her earrings, she said the only thing that could have turned Grandma into a lifelong Hillary devotee. "Oh, I love your suit. That's gorgeous," Hillary exclaimed before we crowded around her for a quick photo. Grandma melted. That photo booted pictures of all her other grandchildren and both of her deceased husbands off the TV mantle and gave me, the "you should be so pretty" granddaughter, the most prominent position in her house until she died. I have at least two chins in the picture and am stretching out a corduroy blazer to within an inch of its life. I'm standing to Hillary's left, lopsided, my shoulder weighted down by my suede leather satchel with my ThinkPad and my notebooks and my multiple water bottles. Grandma stands to the right, and in the middle is Hillary in a coral blouse and a matching coral choker, color coordination after Grandma Rose's heart. Hillary looks so young, a good 20 years younger than she did by the end of the 2016 campaign. The day of Grandma's funeral, I was in the middle of closing a story and needed to explain why I'd be late with the fact-checking. Trying to buy time and a little sympathy, I told the guys my grandma died and sent the photo of the three of us in Waco in 2008. A couple of weeks later in New York, I received a letter with a post office box return address. I ripped it open, not thinking much of it. "Dear Amy, I was so sorry to learn of the loss of your beloved grandmother, Rose. Please accept my heartfelt condolences. At this difficult time, I hope you are comforted by the love she shared for you, the many lessons she imparted, and the memories you cherished together. I am so grateful that I had the chance to meet your grandmother on the campaign trail in 2008. The guys shared the lovely photo of us from that occasion. As you mourn her passing and celebrate her life, please know that my thoughts and prayers are with you, your family, and all those whose lives she touched. Your grandmother was loved by many, and she will be dearly missed. With deepest sympathy, I am, sincerely yours, Hillary." Signed, the parallel scrawl of an ink-blue fountain pen. Chapter 30, Prince Harry. Las Vegas, February 20th. 2016. Hillary needed to win Nevada, which by then I'd learned to always pronounce as Nevada and never Nevada. Another loss would have crippled Brooklyn, already dumbfounded and dysfunctional after underestimating Bernie. "He's not even a Democrat," was a refrain from Clinton hands, almost as popular as, "He literally knows nothing." Robbie's survival rested on Nevada, too. He'd been Hillary's state director there during the 2008 caucuses, where he polled out 51% of the vote, establishing his prodigy status, and some rowdy nights and bottle service at a nightclub named the Foundation Room. Back then, the Culinary Workers Union, the all-powerful labor union that represented 60,000 casino and hotel workers, had endorsed Obama. Bill Clinton accused the union's leadership of pressuring its members, the hard-working people who wash their sheets and cook their food, to caucus for Obama. "I haven't seen tactics like that in a decade," Bill told me at Caesar's Palace. His proof? Chelsea. "My daughter is a scrupulously honest person," Clinton said, as if to acknowledge that he wasn't. "She heard them. She heard what they were saying." Chelsea stood at a safe distance, shaking hands, seemingly oblivious to her father using her as a pawn in this latest political fight. A little later, when she noticed I was wearing a LasVegas.com lanyard, she introduced herself to me. "Hi, I'm Chelsea," she said, extending a hand. I introduced myself back, telling her I was a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. Awkward pause. "Oh, I thought you were with Vegas.com," she said, and abruptly turned her back. That was the first time I met Chelsea Clinton. 8 years later, Hillary had the Democratic establishment on her side. For months, Robbie assured supporters that Nevada would be a Western firewall. The diverse population reflected the country's changing demographics, i.e. young, Latino, Asian American, and would install Hillary in her rightful place as the nominee in waiting. But after New Hampshire, panic set in. Bernie, now flush with cash from online donations from 19-year-old bros in boxer shorts, had gained ground in Nevada. Suddenly, the state wasn't diverse. On conference calls, Robbie warned donors that Hillary could lose. Hired Gun Guy explained that about 80% of caucus voters in that state are white, giving Bernie the same advantage he had in Iowa and New Hampshire. In addition to this being a significant bending of reality, the campaign's newfound portrayal of Nevada enraged Harry Reid, the most powerful Democrat in the Senate, and arguably the most powerful man in Nevada. Iowa and New Hampshire are 86.2% and 90.8% white, respectively, and Nevada is 49.9% white. A decade earlier, Reid had lobbied Congress to give the state an early caucus precisely because of its diverse and booming Latino and Asian populations. Reid hadn't endorsed either candidate in the 2016 primary, and he was exasperated with the Clintons. But he also wanted his beloved caucuses, still treated by the political elites as the ugly stepchild of the early voting process, especially that year when the GOP primary in South Carolina attracted the media's nearly undivided attention, to play a major part in choosing the nominee. And Reid, like most of the Democratic establishment, worried that if Bernie continued to gain momentum, Hillary, who was their only shot at defeating the Republicans, would emerge from the primary's damaged goods. So on the Thursday morning before the caucuses, Harry Reid, who had publicly remained neutral, made a phone call that tipped the Democratic primary in Hillary's favor. After some small talk about my hair, Reid told me he'd called Dee Taylor, the president of the parent union of the culinary workers. The union hadn't endorsed either candidate and hadn't signaled whether it would push to get its members, housekeepers and cocktail waitresses and short-order cooks who heavily favored Hillary, paid time off on a busy Saturday afternoon to participate in the time-consuming caucuses. "He's been extremely cooperative," Reid told me of his talk with Dee Taylor. "Probably 100 organizers will be at the caucus sites and in hotels to make sure people know what they're doing." And they did. Dozens of women in chocolate brown uniforms took a break from their jobs as casino porters at the Bellagio to line up outside the Milano One Ballroom on the promenade level of Caesar's Palace. They told me they were from Honduras and Nicaragua and Guatemala and Mexico. They carried boxed lunches in one hand and American flags in the other. All of them said they were there to caucus por la Hillary. "She'll change immigration. She'll change the economy. She'll change todo," said Dora Gonzalez, a 54-year-old Honduran with bright red lipstick and black waves of hair that fell to her mid-chest, held back with two silver barrettes. And she's a mujer, added her friend Elba Piñera, who wore gold hoop earrings and had reading glasses perched on her shirt collar. The Milano One ballroom was coated in gold paint and gold Grecian-themed carpet and coral-colored walls. Elaborate three-pronged sconces filled the windowless room with amber light. The casino workers rushed to claim scuffed conference room seats set up in tight rows across the 2,000-square-foot ballroom.